Final case this morning will be Teardrop Cattle Company v. Devon Energy Production, number 24-8001. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Let me be the first to wish you a good afternoon. My name is Clay Gregerson, and along with Jeff Oven at Council Table, we represent Devon Energy Production Company. It's my intent to reserve about 3 minutes for rebuttal today. This case pertains to various agreements regarding the use of lands owned by Teardrop Cattle Company and the use related to oil and gas operations and that require payment for that use. Devon assigned those agreements in 2016 to two related entities, Moriah Powder River and Carbon Creek Energy. For years after that assignment, Moriah and Carbon Creek worked with Teardrop exclusively and without Devon. They reclaimed, they made payments, they followed the agreements. But in 2019, those payments stopped. And it was only after Moriah filed for bankruptcy that Teardrop demanded that Devon remit payment, and this litigation followed. We're here today asking the court to reverse the district court's orders, first granting Devon's motion for to dismiss on mootness, or alternatively, the district court's summary judgment orders finding Devon remained liable under those agreements after its assignment. The first issue the court needs to address is jurisdictional and whether this case should be here in the first place. In the fall of 2022.
Well, let me ask you on that question. This goes to whether the counterclaim should be moved.
Yes, Your
correct?
Honor.
And Devon moved to dismiss, well, to dismiss as moot, but moved to dismiss the counterclaim as moot. So if this is a close issue, not saying it is or isn't, but let's assume it is, does that mean that Devon has the burden to show mootness because it was the moving party on the issue?
I believe as the moving party, yes, it would be Devon's burden to show mootness.
Okay.
And I believe that Devon did. In this case, years into the litigation, and in the fall of 2022, Moriah paid Teardrop everything. They didn't just pay Teardrop the amounts Teardrop was claiming in this litigation. They didn't just pay Teardrop the amounts that had accrued since this litigation started up to that point. They also paid Teardrop all of its claims for interest on those payments. They paid Teardrop all of its claims, potential claims for penalties based on those payments being late. And it paid all of Teardrop's attorney's fees incurred in this litigation. At that point in time, there was nothing under the agreements that was in dispute. Teardrop couldn't bring a claim under these agreements because there was nothing to bring a claim on. Teardrop couldn't make a demand based on these agreements because there was nothing to demand.
How did that line up with the fact that didn't Teardrop sue Devon again in 2022 for delinquent payments?
It did, and that case was dismissed because of the payment that Carbon Creek and
Right,
MRI
but it
made.
Happened again.
It I did.
Mean, okay, and isn't it at least reasonably likely that the assignees might fail to make their payments again, given that they're still in bankruptcy?
It may be, but that's not the relevant inquiry. The relevant inquiry isn't about whether it might happen in the future.
Well, why isn't it the relevant inquiry? If it's likely or reasonably likely to happen, why would it be moot?
Because the standard is whether or not, under mootness, there are direct real-world impacts and a change in the party's behavior that will result from a decision from the court. At that point in time, and upon curing all defaults and making good on all obligations under the agreements, there was nothing that a decision from the court would have required to happen, would have changed in the party's behavior.
Well, counsel, can I ask you, though, you invited this inquiry by filing a counterclaim for declaratory judgment, which is necessarily asking the court to determine your rights so that the parties would then know how to proceed in the future. And so one concern I have is, as I was reviewing the record, it seems as if Devon has argued about the declaratory judgment statute in Wyoming before the Wyoming Supreme Court, but also within this case, and saying that it should be construed very broadly. And in fact, at one point before the district court here, I believe in an opposition to summary judgment, essentially making an argument that differs maybe even 180 degrees from the one you're making now and saying it's moot. So my concern is about judicial estoppel. And why shouldn't we attribute Devon's prior arguments about how to construe this statute in this case and in other cases, which seems to me to be opposite of what you're arguing today?
I don't believe it's inconsistent, Your Honor. When we made those arguments, and frankly, I do, the Wyoming Declaratory Judgment Act is a very broad act, but it still requires a live case in controversy. It still requires some change in behavior from a decision from the court. Now, when we made the argument about this case being broader, that was after summary judgment, the first summary judgment order had been issued in Teardrop's favor as to just Teardrop's claims. When the district court, after that order, basically said the case is done, and we said, hey, hold on a second, the case isn't done. There's other claims between us and third parties, and there's also our declaratory judgment action. The important distinction at that point in time was that there were payments outside of what Teardrop was claiming in this case that had become due. And the payments that Teardrop was claiming hadn't been paid. So there was still that outstanding obligation under these agreements that hadn't been fulfilled. That's what gave it the live case in controversy. That's what gave it this a decision from this court impact.
Well, you didn't specify that, though, in this pleading opposing summary judgment. You just simply argued that Teardrop's claims didn't address the broader question in the counterclaim involving successive and future payments, whether Devon could be held liable for those obligations and amounts, or Devon's ability to terminate or stop access under the agreement. Well, you yourself characterized this as a very, very broad counterclaim.
We did, Your Honor, and because
very
it was.
Broad. It was, and you it, asked for this.
We asked for, because there was issues, because there was hundreds of thousands of dollars at issue, and we suspected, just as Teardrop
did, future potential obligation, right?
Exactly.
Right.
And we wanted a decision on that because...
And there still is, if you don't get a decision on that.
Not currently, there's not.
Okay.
There's no obligations that are outstanding right now.
Well, but you didn't talk about right now. You talked about potentially future obligations if you did not get a decision on that issue.
We talked about successive payments, which at that time there were successive payments. By the time Teardrop even filed its lawsuit, there were successive payments.
And future payments.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one technical procedural point I just want to make sure I'm clear about, because you're here arguing that, that the counterclaim should go away. I assume that Devon couldn't simply dismiss the counterclaim because under Rule 41A. That's why it's still there. Is that right?
It, too much time had passed and we weren't going to get consent from Teardrop to do so.
And we have authority that says that you're stuck with, unless it's moved.
Right.
Okay.
The next issue before the court today is the interpretation of the agreements and whether the Penico cases, two Wyoming Supreme Court cases, would hold that Devon remained liable after it assigned those to Carbon Creek and Mariah. Now I want to emphasize this. We're not asking this court to overturn Penico. We don't think Penico was wrongly decided.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's just a threshold leading into your argument. Why should we review summary judgment on the summary judgment order on Teardrop's claims when the parties in the district court have all said the claims are moot?
Because it's that decision, if you read the decision on our counterclaims.
I have.
It's that first decision that was the entire basis of that second decision. And so it's the same rationale from the first decision. And so whether you're reviewing the second or the first, it's the same question, threshold question.
Same question, but are we reviewing that order?
I don't necessarily think the court has to review that order. I think the court could simply review
the second question. All right.
Yeah, because it's the same Penico analysis that goes into it.
All right.
And to my point, we're not asking for Penico to be overruled or changed. We're simply asking for it to be applied as it was written. And that's under Wyoming's well-established rules for contract interpretation, which seek to both ascertain and imply the intent of the parties, based primarily on the contract language. And the issue is whether or not in these agreements the parties intended to create obligations that are connected to Devon and would stay with Devon after assignment, or were obligations connected to the use of the land and would therefore pass with the assignment. This is necessarily a case-by-case and agreement-by-agreement determination, and we're asking the court to apply it that way. The problem in this case can be seen how Teardrop characterizes the Penico decisions. They characterize them as policy decisions. As policy decisions.
Oh.
Where the Wyoming Supreme Court was faced with a situation where landowners like Teardrop had defunct or bankrupt operators and were thus stuck with oil and gas facilities all over their land that they were promised would be cleaned up. And so the Wyoming Supreme Court said, we are going to make a new categorical rule where we interpret these kinds of oil and gas agreements differently than any other agreement, and assigning operators automatically remain liable. That's not what the court said in Penico. What the court did in Penico was apply the same rules it applies in any contract interpretation to determine the intent of the parties. And frankly, I don't think it would be appropriate for the Wyoming Supreme Court to come up with such a policy decision, because that would be the purview of the legislature. And if the Supreme Court in Wyoming was going to do that in the Penico cases, they certainly would have said so, and they didn't.
Counsel, can you help me understand this, though? Because Teardrop wasn't a party to this assignment. And so, as I recall, the district court found that the agreement was not ambiguous as to liability after assignment. And then, as I also understand it, there was no written novation afterwards. So is your argument just that by Teardrop going directly to the assignees for payment and dealing with them, essentially acknowledging that your client was cut out, that's enough then to transfer not just Devon's rights under the contract, but their obligations as well?
Right. Well, there's a lot to unpack in that question.
There is.
Right?
I agree.
So there's two separate issues here, and they have two separate timelines that you have to keep in mind. Penico is about the intent in the agreements and whether or not purely the assignment would discharge Devon from its obligations. That's based on interpreting the contracts, and that's based on the moment they were assigned. The second question is novation. Novation is based upon after that, and it presumes that Devon was not released at the moment of assignment based on the intent of the parties. That question is then based on everything that happened in the years after that. And yes, we do not have an express written novation in this case, but the law is clear that novation, like other agreements, can be implied and based upon the conduct of the parties. And so what we're arguing, particularly at this stage, is that summary judgment was inappropriate on novation because those years of conduct and working with Teardrop working with Mariah and Carbon Creek created a question of fact as to whether or not there was the intent to discharge Devon through the substitution and replacement with Carbon
Creek.
What was
the evidence that showed a clear manifestation of assent? Clear manifestation of assent.
Right.
To release your client.
So I think an important distinction to make is our burden at trial is to show a clear intent to do that. Our burden at summary judgment is to provide sufficient evidence that a jury mm-hmm. could find that at trial mm-hmm. based on weighing the evidence.
You gotta have something.
Right. Mm-hmm. And our evidence in this case is the years of working with Mariah and all with the complete absence of Devon.
What case law did you have to show that from a novation standpoint, just assenting to their payment somehow releases the actual contracting party from their obligations?
Well, we aren't making the argument that simply accepting payment is not enough. And I would agree
with
you.
What else do you have?
What we have is the fact that it's not just accepting performance, it's that when performance was deficient, Teardrop looked to Carbon Creek and Mariah to fix it. And it wasn't just that they looked for them to fix it. It's not an issue of, hey, you were supposed to reclaim this well, you didn't do a good job, come back out, and then
they
do it.
Well, of course they would look to them first. I mean, why wouldn't they do that?
But that
until they couldn't pay
right.
or they
well,
couldn't fix it, and then they looked to the obligor.
Well, it's certainly evidence that could be interpreted in a light most favorable to Devon that they believe that that's because that obligation was Carbon Creek and Mariah's mm-hmm. and only theirs.
Any case law to support that?
Yeah, I believe the Gulf Coast, Gulf Oil case that we cited, it talks about this is very analogous. Case of Lewis in Wyoming talks about novation, talks about implied novation of looking at the conduct of the parties.
But don't we only analyze that type of evidence if we don't find the answer by first looking within the four corners mm-hmm. of the document itself?
No, but again, that's the separate question between whether or not the contract itself would discharge Devon after an assignment. And
so if we conclude
novation.
That the contract itself does not discharge Devon, then the rest of this is irrelevant.
No, it would be the opposite. If the contract concludes that the assignment would discharge Devon, then novation becomes irrelevant because we wouldn't need a novation. If the contract assumes that and has the intent that Devon would not be discharged, then novation comes in to see, well, whether or not Devon was discharged regardless of what the intent of the contract was. And I see I'm running out of time. There is
well, can
two...
you? I would on the Penico decision, which you started to talk about, you seem to be suggesting that the district court or didn't really consider it as a factual issue. And I think, you know, there's some reason to believe that Penico 2 made it black letter law, but and that this just simply doesn't doesn't pass muster. But district court did an alternative approach. It said, all right, if it's black letter, here's my answer. And my answer is the same if you look at the various factors that were set out in Pinnacle 1 and discussed again in slightly different form in Pinnacle 2. It looked at it both ways.
It did, but I don't believe it applied it correctly. In contract interpretation, you're supposed to apply the language to arrive at the intent. And I agree that Pinnacle 2 was a shorter analysis, but that makes sense because Pinnacle 1 was a question of first interpretation. I see I'm out of time, if you wouldn't mind. Pinnacle 1 was the first time that the court had to address this question. And so what it did was it went through a detailed analysis. It said, these are the kind of obligations that stay with the assigning party. These are the kind of obligations that don't. It said, this is how we're going to figure it out. We're going to compare different obligations from different other contracts. Then it had to say, okay, so this is what we think is important. It went and applied that to several different agreements with multiple parties. And then it recapped and said, here are all the factors that we're looking at. And then it also had interveners and amicus briefs that it had to address their arguments of. That's a lot of analysis. Pinnacle 2 didn't hardly have any of that. And Pinnacle 2 already had Pinnacle 1 saying, this is the important factors, this is what we're going to look at. And it did, and Pinnacle 2 reiterated that we're doing this on a case-by-case, contract-by-contract interpretation. And it primarily relied on the connection between reclamation and annual payments. And again, we've highlighted this extensively in our brief here. It's about use. And I apologize for going on, but I do like to make one point on the point of use. Is the court in Pinnacle talked about the connection between annual payments and reclamation to support that obligation. It specifically said that connecting the obligation to use would show a servitude. That's exactly what the surface use agreement does here. And it's important to note that the surface use agreement has two different payment provisions for the construction of well sites and using this land. The first is initial payment, $1,900 if you want to build a well site. The second is an annual payment for the continued use. And unlike in Pinnacle, where that annual payment was specifically for damages, the surface use agreement in this case specifies expressly in Section 4 that it's that initial payment that is paying for the right for that building to be there, for those facilities to be there. That's the damages payment. That's the one-time payment. The annual payment in Section 5 is expressly about use. That connects to the operator that's currently working on it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Toner. I represent Teardrop Cattle Company. My law firm represented both of the ranchers in the Pinnacle cases. Our ranchers in the Powder River Basin were faced with a plague of these major oil companies abandoning the wells to these startup companies that were financially irresponsible and then leaving the country with all these wells and not paying for them. So we brought a number of lawsuits beginning in 2011 against these major oil companies. And we thought we finally got it resolved in the Pinnacle cases, which were decided in December of 2015 and March of 2016, when the Wyoming Supreme Court said, if you have a surface damage agreement relating to the production of oil and gas on Wyoming land, you do not escape liability on that contract by assigning it to somebody else. You have to either have an exculpatory clause that says upon assignment you're released, or the landowner has to release you. Well, we thought that sort of resolved it.
And am I right that your argument is there is no exculpatory clause here and the contract's not ambiguous as to that point?
That's exactly right. Exculpatory clause. These contracts are not ambiguous. They're either a contract or they're a servitude. They're one or the other, and you look just at the paper. There's no argument about what Devin intended or didn't intend. As the court said in Pinnacle, we don't know what secret intentions Devin had. We look at the four corners of the document.
And there's certainly nothing in the record to indicate that Teardrop released Devin.
No, the testimony is absolutely to the contrary. Devin's prime man on this, Brian Carlson, testified they never negotiated with Teardrop for a release. They never told Teardrop that they were no longer obligated after they assigned it. They never repudiated the contract. Teardrop never signed a contract with Carbon Creek or Mariah. And when they asked us to amend the agreements to cut him some slack while they were making some payments. Teardrop refused to do it because we knew what would happen. If we ever changed the contracts in the least bit, we'd be faced with a new ration market. And so that's what happened. So what happened here is the reason those dates of the decisions of Pinnacle are so important is because Devin, when they entered into the contract with Mariah, they testified they knew about both of the Pinnacle cases. They knew they were there. And so here they were losing $6 million a year. They had to unload this money-losing asset. They knew about the Pinnacle cases. They knew that there weren't exculpatory clauses in any of their provisions, in any of the contracts. None of them have that. So they decided they were going to give what they did. They gave the assets away, hundreds of wells, all this equipment for $0. Plus, they agreed to pay them $7 million to take these wells and plumb them. So that's the factual situation we're dealing with here. Now, in our brief in the Pinnacle cases, we referred to some authority that certainly says or announces the principle more clearly than I ever could. It came from a professor, Charles Knapp, at the New York University. He wrote a book called Problems in Contract Law in 1976. And he talked about assigning rights and delegating duties. And I would never have thought of this, but here's what he said. He said, if assigning a right is like passing a football, then delegating a duty resembles more the dissemination of a catchy tune or a communicable disease. Passing it along is not the same as getting rid of it. And Devin knew that when they entered into the contract with Mariah, they knew they couldn't pass it along. So what they did, knowing that they didn't have an exculpatory clause in their contracts, they were making a big bet. They were betting that this company that was just formed, couldn't provide any financial statements or financial assurances, was going to be able to make the payments to Teardrop, and they wouldn't have to worry about it. Well, they lost that bet, but now they're calling on Teardrop to pay their losses. But of course, Devin, I get these companies mixed up sometimes. Devin is a shrewd company. They're a major oil company. So they hedged their bets. And in their contract that they signed with Mariah, they didn't give all the rights that they had under the Teardrop agreements away. They kept some. They reserved the right that if Mariah defaulted on Teardrop's payment, they reserved the right to come in and make the payment. If Mariah didn't reclaim Teardrop's property, Devin reserved the right in their contract to come on to the Teardrop ranch and do the reclamation. And just like in the Pinnacle cases, exactly the same, they reserved the so-called deep rights in the Teardrop lands and in the leases. And they reserved the right to come on, just like in Pinnacle, the Teardrop lands to produce their deep rights. And not only that, that contract says if the coal bed methane wells that they had passed on to Mariah Carbon Creek were producing and holding the deep rights under the terms of the oil and gas lease, and if Mariah Carbon Creek wanted to plug that well, they reserved the right to take it back in order to protect their deep rights. So they didn't even give away all of their rights under this contract. They actually kept rights to use the Teardrop land, just like in Pinnacle. Now, you might wonder why I'm here since we got paid. It's a pretty obvious question. It's because of that extremely broad counterclaim that they asserted against us. They wanted a declaration that the contracts were canceled and terminated, that they were not responsible for any future liabilities or breaches, and they were precluded from ever suing them again for anything. Non-payment, reclamation, nothing. We were out. Now, once we won the summary judgment on the complaint, where they were defending, saying, oh, well, these are still servitudes. They're not contracts, or there isn't some kind of novation. They still had this position. You know, their position was stated very clearly. Their head man, again, he said, I asked him this question on his deposition. He said, this is found in the volume 2, page 241. Now, you've mentioned making a full and complete assignment several times. Is it your understanding that Devon was automatically released from its obligations to Teardrop when it made the assignment to Mariah or Carmen Creek? Yes. Yes. The stroke of the pen, they're gone. That was their position. They were claiming these are servitudes.
Well, counsel, could we get focused in a little bit more on this mootness
question? On mootness?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, sure.
Right. So we have the counterclaim, you would prefer it to not to be moot, and they would prefer it to be moot.
Yes.
So why isn't it moot?
It's not moot.
I mean, you've been paid. What's there to be decided at this point that will have real world impact, and why haven't they shown that this is moot?
Well, let me start with one of the questions you were asking, and you were just told that, well, they've been paid since. You know who's paying us? Devon. You don't think this is going to have real world consequence, that counterclaim? If that counterclaim had been granted, do you think we'd got paid a dime after that? They would have gone back to Oklahoma. Because they say, well, this company that's still in bankruptcy after 5 years, maybe they'll pay you in the future. If you look at the appendix, page, volume 5 at page 68 through 73, let me tell you what they wrote about this company that might pay us in the future. It says, throughout the course of this bankruptcy, the debtor has taken actions to the detriment of creditors in the estate, including transferring significant amounts of money on a monthly basis to the debtor's affiliates, PM and CR, that's Powder River Midstream and Carmen Creek, with no supervision over how those funds were spent. The transactions, coupled with the enormous amount of unpaid post-petition obligations of the debtor, raise serious questions concerning the debtor's management of its resources and the property of the bankruptcy estate. Now, that's a pretty real-world consequence. This bankruptcy entity is a walking dead entity. It really is. And there's no way we're going to...
Okay, let me back up. I really want to get to the standard for mootness. And the question is, at least at this point, is there any outstanding payment to your client at this point?
Not today, because Devon just paid us this month. Right before this argument.
Okay. And to the extent that the assignees, Mariah, for example, that they didn't pay, it's Devon who's been paying for them? Is that what you're telling us?
No, Devon's been paying for Devon. It's their obligation.
Well, I understand that I understand that. But if this were to repeat, if history repeats itself, how does it play out? Do the assignees not pay, and then you ask to be paid, and then maybe Devon pays, and how likely is that to happen? Because if it's likely, that's a better argument that it's not moot, but if all we're talking is speculation, then maybe not. So why is this still a live issue?
It's still a live issue because if you, if there is a decision that these are servitudes, which they've asked you to decide in this case. They've argued that they're servitudes. They're going to back to Oklahoma, and they're never going to pay us again. You know, what's going on right now is the payment comes due. We send them a notice of default. Mariah Carbon Creek does not pay, and eventually Devon pays. Now, that may or may not continue. it's highly unlikely that it will continue if their arguments in this case succeed, is that it's a servitude or it's a novation. And that's what their position is. So it can't be moot. The second you do, this case has to be decided, because if it isn't, they're not going to pay anymore. Why would they?
Well, but then you can sue them.
Pardon?
But then you can sue them, and then you resurrect that dispute.
See, then we start over, right? I mean, ranchers don't have unlimited access to attorney fees. Some of these contracts don't have attorney fee provisions. And if Devin just says, well, sue us, what's the worst that can happen? We'll have to pay you what we owe you, or maybe not, or maybe because of our economic power, you'll give up. And that happens, because sometimes the ranchers just can't afford to do it.
Counsel, can I ask you about the one issue that was raised that we haven't discussed today, and that's the Wyoming Split Estate Act?
Yeah.
And as I understand Devin's argument, they're saying, well, we're not actually an oil and gas producer anymore because, you know, we're just not in that business. So therefore, we're not liable under this act. I think I know your answer to this, but I'd like to invite you to tell me why they're wrong.
Well, because you can't, if their argument makes no sense. If you're contractually obligated to make the payment, and the Wyoming legislature passed a law specifically to be sure that the landowner gets paid and the oil companies don't get to keep somebody else's money, and it's a remedial statute, they're saying, yes, we're liable for the payment, but if we decide not to pay you, we can defeat this purpose of the legislature and claim that we're not currently operating. And the question is, were they engaged? Now, Judge, if you want to look at the district court decisions, and I understand you guys give it due regard, and since it hasn't been decided by the Wyoming Supreme Court, what have our district courts held every time? And the same law firm that represents Devin here has lost this argument at least four times against our firm in other cases when they were representing a company called Anadarko. The courts have said, if you're contractually liable for it, and you've got the contractual liability, that is necessarily linked to the statutory liability. Otherwise, it makes no sense. And the other point I would make on that is, remember, they reserved the deep rights. They still have the operating rights under Teardrop land, and they have the right to take over a coal bed methane well on Teardrop land right now, today, if they thought they had to do it in order to protect their deep rights.
I have a slightly different but related question on the Split Estate Act double damages. If the parties have agreed that Teardrop's claims in this case are moot, why isn't that issue moot?
Well, I guess the whole case would be moot then. They're complaining about the...
Well, no, we're talking about if there's going to be any split or double damage payment, it would be on your claims.
Yes.
And they've been paid, and both sides say they're gone. That those claims are gone. They're moot. Why should this Split Estate Act even apply at this point? We don't have anything to apply it to.
Well, no, but they wanted to, they've asked for a ruling from this court that says they are not responsible because they're not a current operator.
And I understand that was the colloquy leading up to my question, but my question is whether this gets off the ground at all because your claims are moot.
Well, of course, I don't think the claims are moot.
No, you agreed that those claims were moot. Agree that the counterclaim is moot, but Teardrop's initial claims have been mooted. They've been paid. Both sides agreed they're moot. So how do we even reach the double damages issue?
It's fine with me if you don't want to reach that issue. I mean, they raised it as an issue in the case. I had to respond to it. I agree with you.
Weren't you seeking the double damage?
Yes.
Okay, are you conceding that issue today because it's moot?
I'm not conceding the issue. I'm saying they're still liable. If this issue ever comes up again.
If it comes up again, I'm just talking about the part of the case that isn't part of the case anymore.
That's right. It would not be part of the case, but for the fact they've listed it as an issue on appeal. And I had to respond to it. I'm comfortable that we go back into Wyoming court.
Okay, let me just back up and put it this way. Does Devon owe you any payments at this point on the Wyoming Split Estate Act?
No.
All right.
They do not.
That's helpful.
Okay. And they didn't ask for this particular ruling in terms of any future obligations. They were relating it to your claim in this particular action. So that makes this claim moot, essentially.
Yes, it would. But it's nonetheless
here. I see
here.
Your point. You respond.
No, I understand. Yeah. You were responding to a brief.
Right. But,
okay. Thank you.
I think I'm way over. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thanks to both of you. Appreciate the arguments this afternoon. And the case is submitted and counsel are excused.